God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in D.C., let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
When the God of the universe created the world, he didn't snap his fingers or wink his eye. He spoke. God said, let there be light. Because we believe, we speak about the happenings in this world, mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and his kingdom. Welcome to A Disciple's View. I'm Todd Herman. We ask in the program, what is the top story to God? And I'll continue to say that the top story is that redemption is available as a free gift given through love. God supplies that in the person of Jesus Christ. It is ours for the asking, something we cannot earn. That will be the top story until Jesus returns as judge. We don't know when that's going to happen. We just know it's going to happen. And in fact, because God says it will happen, it already has. That's the top story. But what are the secondary stories? There's nothing that surprises God. So there's nothing we talk about in this program that he didn't see coming. And I wonder, to what degree does he laugh? Because I do think God laughs. In fact, the Bible tells us God laughs at the schemes of wicked leaders. He finds them amusing because their wickedry, is that a word, by the way? Wickedry should be a word. Could I trademark that? Randy, could you check and see if I can trademark wickedry? Is it? I think I could. Wickedry, I like that. That God laughs at the wickedry of people who contend or think that they can get around God's design for human beings, for the world, for leadership, for what's going to bear lasting fruit. This happened just this past weekend. The guy who runs is an executive at Facebook, Meta, it's called. They renamed themselves Meta so they can own a bunch of things. And Nick Clegg was talking with CNBC about one of the facts about Facebook that sort of caught the interviewers by surprise.
How many people do you have working on this issue, and how do you know what's enough?
So we have around 40,000 people working on kind of safety and integrity on our platforms. Generally, we spend a lot of money on it. We've spent about $20 billion US in recent years on things like election integrity, about $5 billion in the last year alone. But here's the interesting point. You know, even if we employ double the number of content moderators that we have, actually, here's the irony. We're talking here about the risks of AI-generated content.
Did you hear the whispering in the background? Those were the CNBC hosts. They're 60% of their employees. 60% of the Facebook employees, Meta, as they want us to call them, because it includes Instagram and other things they purchased. 60% of them are working on making sure that you don't get to say the things you want to say. Well, you can say them, but not be heard on their platform. 60%. Now, where this is headed is something I do think rises to a level of godly concern. Obviously, God was the Word and is the Word. In the beginning, God was the Word and was the Word was with God and God was the Word. We know that. So they can't stamp out the Word. God's Word will never return void, nor will the words of Jesus Christ ever disappear. They can't. God says they won't, therefore they haven't, and they shall not. But they try to stomp out truth. What's going on in France is very much similar to what's been going on at Facebook. This is not something most people have heard about. John Leake wrote about this at Courageous Discourse. There is a new medical law in France, and it is a full extension of tyranny to control the body. Now, listen to this. This is English French translated into English. Therefore, it might be a little bit chunky, but it's a pretty faithful translation as far as I can tell. It is punishable by 1 year of imprisonment and a fine of 30,000 euros for the inducement by means of repeated pressure or actions of any person suffering from a pathology to cease or abstain from following a prescribed medical treatment, therapeutic or prophylactic, when the cessation or abstention is presented as beneficial for the health of the person concerned, whereas it is, in the state of medical knowledge, clearly likely to cause for them, taking into account the pathology of which they are affected, particularly serious consequences for their physical or psychological health. I know that's a great, big, huge mouthful of French translated into English, so let's break it down. The government can force you to take any medicine at any time. The government can force you to be in psychological therapy at any time for any reason whatsoever. Now remember, this was a mass injection country, France. Remember, it's a forced immigration country, France. Remember, there are now no-go zones in France run by violent Muslim migrants, they're called. Well, illegal immigrants, except the EU, of course, waived all immigration laws and simply flooded the country with people who apparently hate France. This law, depending on who interprets it, could mean that you could be taken to therapy because you have the pathology of saying that a man is a man. After all, that could be a psychological disorder. They actually referred in Europe to people who didn't want to get injected with the COVID shots as having a psychological disorder. Here's another portion of the law, Article 4. It is punishable by the same penalties when there's inducement to receive treatment and the prescribed treatment is presented by having a therapeutic or prophylactic purpose, when in fact it is obvious, given the state of medical knowledge, that these practices expose them to an immediate risk of death or injury likely to result in mutilation or permanent infirmity. Notice this. They keep saying, given the state of medical knowledge. The state of medical knowledge doesn't exist. There's no such thing as the state of medical knowledge. There are opinions. There are even theories. There are theories that prove to be very, very, very hard to disprove. But there is no state of medical knowledge. When COVID was used first to lock down society, the state of medical knowledge was do not lock down society in the case of an upper respiratory virus. That was the state of things. How do I know that? Because advisors to Tony Fauci wrote a paper, one of the most cited and distributed and respected papers in history, saying do not lock down in the case of an upper respiratory virus. That was the state of medical knowledge. That was ignored. Also in France. You see, the top story, I think, to God is this. You're going to force my children to ingest medicines harmful to them because human wisdom says so? Because you have the power to do this? This is the same God who has cautioned people who've been given the ability to lead others, steward leadership, to not lord it over others. That's what they've been told. Do not lord this over others and see what's going on in France. Now, see, this is endemic. It's endemic in a society where the godless elite, and hear me, please, I don't know every single person who works at Facebook. I know very few, maybe 20. The people I do know who work there are, in fact, godless. Now, that's a very small sample size. I'm sure there are Christian people within Facebook. I'm sure of it. They shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be there because it's a godless company, but they're there. It's endemic to a godless elite class that shows their godlessness by the fruits of what they support. In the case of Meta-Facebook, it couldn't be more clear. The God they worship, it's control, human control. And it's endemic. It goes beyond the walls of Facebook. It goes beyond the walls of the United States. This is the Canadian Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland. This was way back in the day when they were busy taking the bank accounts of truckers who simply wanted to be able to truck and feed their families. She was asked about the constitutionality of freezing bank accounts.
So you're confirming that accounts have been frozen, both personal and corporate, but you're not releasing the information. And the actual follow-up is, I'm just wondering whether the bank accounts will be targeted of individuals who donated to the Give, Send, Go and the GoFundMe campaigns. Are they considered designated people under the Emergencies Act, meaning that their credit cards could be cut and financial services are targeting them as well?
Okay, so the names of both individuals and entities, as well as crypto wallets, have been shared by the RCMP with financial institutions, and accounts have been frozen, and more accounts will be frozen. Crowdfunding platforms and payment service providers have started the registration process with FinTrack. In terms of the specifics on whose accounts are being frozen, you now have the regulations. The financial service providers have those regulations as well. And they, working with law enforcement, will be making the operational decisions.
I hope you heard her laughing at the beginning of the clip. Giggling, in fact. Well, God will not be mocked. Do not withhold from the laborers their wages. God will not be mocked. She, Chrystia Freelander, the Deputy Prime Minister of the fallen country of Canada, and Justin Trudeau, the dictator of the fallen country of Canada, are actually being sued as individuals. This has actually made it into a court in Canada because of what they did to people's wages. Now, I'm not here to say that I think that court is a godly court. Canada, sadly, is almost completely unchurched in terms of the number of people who even attend church. And attending church is only consuming the word of God. I mean, bless it. God's word never returns void, but it certainly not doesn't equate always to following God or walking with the Lord Jesus. Far from it. But there is this that people see. They can sense that it's wrong. And so they're fighting. Mike Benz is a commentator on national security issues. He had a discussion with Tucker Carlson that sounds very, very familiar to me because I've been covering this topic for about 3 years on my podcast in depth. I've been making the same case because the evidence has been right here in front of us. Mike Benz talking to Tucker Carlson.
The Atlanta Council in January 2017 moved immediately to pressure European governments to pass censorship laws to create a transatlantic flank attack on free speech in exactly the way that Rick Stengel essentially called for, to have U.S. mimic European censorship laws. One of the ways they did this was by getting Germany to pass something called NetzDG in August 2017, which was essentially kicked off the era of automated censorship in the U.S. What NetzDG required was, unless social media platforms wanted to pay a $54 million fine for each instance of speech, each post left up on their platform for more than 48 hours that had been identified as hate speech, they would be fined basically into bankruptcy when you aggregate $54 million over tens of thousands of posts per day. And the safe haven around that was if they deployed artificial intelligence-based censorship technologies, which had been, again, created by DARPA to take on ISIS, to be able to scan and ban speech automatically.
Now, see, we've been talking about this on the podcast for about 3 years. It first came out that in Britain, they were using that type of technology, not just to censor their citizens, but to bifurcate the information they know. This is so important to understand. You are dealing with victims of information hiding that's worked. And your government's doing it at a military level. There's people who simply don't know the truth. Except God needs them to know the truth. Guess what? That's our job. I'm Todd Herman. This is The Disciples View. We'll continue. Welcome back to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. You certainly remember the phrase, the safest, most secure election in history. You might not remember that it was a phrase created by a Microsoft lawyer who'd loaned himself out to the government to oversee elections. Experience in elections, but loaned himself out nonetheless. I always ask this question as a follow-up. What was second place? You've said this is the safest, most secure election in history, so what was second place? No one has ever answered that, because the fact is, we don't measure things that way. When people use superlatives like that, it's almost always a lie. Almost always. I contend the election was stolen. I know it was rigged. It was obviously rigged. Last week on my podcast, I had an interview with Chris Talgo with the Heartland Institute. And if you doubt the election was rigged or stolen, wait until you hear some of the evidence that Chris presented. I would ask you to go look at the entire program. I said, look at it, because the visuals are vital and important. So you can subscribe to the video portion of my podcast at video.thetoddhermanshow.com. It costs about 27 cents per day. And you can see the electoral maps that you'll hear us reference here. So in conjunction with Rasmussen, what they did was sent out a survey to a large number of voters to ask them some questions about what they did during this particular election cycle. And you'll be surprised how many people didn't know they were admitting vote fraud, but actually did admit it.
Yeah, so what we did was we polled 1,085 people across the country with the help of Rasmussen reports. And we didn't ask them whether or not they voted fraudulently in the 2020 election. What we did was this. We asked them, did you vote in 2020? And then we separated them into two buckets, those who voted in person and those who voted by mail. All of the statistics that you just mentioned were only from those who voted by mail. So that means that 20%, this was our baseline, our low baseline, 20% of mail-in voters admitted to committing at least one type of election fraud, whether that's voting in a state in which they were no longer a permanent resident, voting on behalf of someone else, or filling out a ballot and then putting into a Dropbox, even though it's someone else's ballot. So what we realized initially was, wow, this was a lot more than we expected. We expected maybe 10-15%. But then afterwards, we got the raw data back from Rasmussen, and we dug even deeper into it. And upon further analysis, we found that 28.2% of mail-in voters in the 2020 election admitted that they committed one of those election fraud. So that was our new number, which we use in the report, is actually closer to 30% of mail-in voters admitting that they committed at least one type of an election fraud in 2020.
So you can listen to that and go, yeah, but this is a husband taking a wife's ballot to a drop box. And probably there were instances like that for sure. And when the system is filled with that many holes, we would have to rely on our own wisdom to think that human beings wouldn't take advantage of that. When people are willing to spend billions of dollars to buy presidential seats, why would they not commit fraud? When they're willing to lie on the level they have to us, why would they not do this? One would have to be foolish to think otherwise, for of course God tells us about the sins and the sin desires of the human heart, this brokenness that we have. Now, that's one aspect of this. This is the vote fraud committed by people, perhaps unknowingly. But there's something else, and it's more global. It has to do with a massive change that the people who wanted to see Joe Biden installed in the White House inflicted upon the country. And that was that COVID was the election, and the election was COVID. And mail-in ballots were the way they got this done. So the rejection rates of mail-in ballots. This is vital. Chris Talgo talking about this. He's with the Heartland Institute. There was an examination of ballot rejections done by MIT. Chris Talgo talked about that, in addition to the work that they did at the Heartland Institute. And here's what they learned.
Not only did we find that the rejection rates were much lower than every other mail-in, every other previous election in terms of mail-in ballots.
Yeah.
But we also found that in the 2020 Democrat primaries in New York and Pennsylvania, for example, the rejection rate was 20%. In the entire 2020 election, the rejection rate for mail-in ballots was 0.79%, which is so much lower than even 2018, 2016, and 2014, 2012, when let's keep in mind that the amount of mail-in ballots in those elections were at least half of what they were in 2020. So it does not pass, the smell test to say we had 65 million mail-in ballots in 2020, but we only rejected 0.79% of them. However, in 2020 primaries in New York and Pennsylvania, for example, which were all Democrat voters because the Republicans didn't have a primary because Trump was incumbent, 20% of those ballots were rejected for the usual problems of they didn't have a proper signature, they didn't maybe sign the envelope properly or whatever the problem was. So how can it go from 20% to less than 1%? It just does not make sense.
No, and it doesn't, and it's not meant to make sense. You have to twist things to say, make it make sense is a current meme. Make it make sense. Well, if you are someone who came from a forced mail voting state like I did, which was a separate country of Washington, we saw this all before, and I won't belabor this because you've heard me say it. We watched a gubernatorial election stolen before our eyes. Everybody knows it. Mail-in ballots are, in fact, meant to, in my judgment, designed to allow the stealing of elections. If you've ever worked in any form of data, any form, and make it a very, very simple form. Let's say that you work at a car wash, okay? Let's say that you were the on-site manager of a car wash. And the owner calls you and says, hey, what kind of day did we have? You could say, oh, it was the greatest day in history. The safest, greatest day in the history of our car wash. Oh, cool. Tell me how you know that. It felt really good. You know, it's a lot of the employees here said it was pretty great. Well, how many cars did you wash? I don't know. Okay. Well, did you see a bunch of new customers or were these all of our regulars? I don't know. When you're talking about mail-in ballots, who voted in that? I don't know. Well, you checked the signatures, right? Not really. Well, but you're pretty sure the person who filled it out is the person who had a right to vote. No. Did you check their ID? No, we don't do that. Okay, but did you consult the database to make sure they still live here? Yeah, no. No. That's the situation we face with mail-in ballots. You do not have the baseline data to say that it's the safest, most secure election in history. You don't have the baseline data to say it wasn't, because we don't have baseline data. Chris Talgo with the Heartland Institute talked about how the narrative around mail-in ballots has changed over the years.
Jim Baker and the former President Carter formed a commission in 2005 to try to get to the bottom of this. And what they said was mail-in voting should be discouraged as much as possible. They came up with a whole bunch of reasons why. And interestingly, in the years that followed that, whether it was NPR, whether it was the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, of course, before 2020, they were all saying that mail-in voting is rife with fraud and we should try to avoid that at all possible costs. Funny how that narrative changed in the blink of an eye right when they knew that they could kind of rig the system in their favor. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has a great ground game compared to the Republican Party. They have those community organizers and those people who are out on the ground, who can go to the nursing homes, who can go to the homeless shelters and can, make sure that they'll get those votes counted. The Republican Party by nature tends to vote much more on election day in person. So, we don't have that advantage that they have been taking, that they've been using for all these years.
No one should be allowed to use this advantage. And if the system wanted to be secure, the system would be secure. there's not a human being alive who thinks it's a good idea to not require voter ID. There's no other way to determine who's voting. There's not a human, no human being thinks that. They will say that. They'll convince themselves to think that. But there's not a human being alive who says, no, you should never check ID, and means it. Chris Tago with the Heartland Institute talked about the high amount of fraud that they found in vote fraud in the key swing states.
Our poll found 28%, but even if we took it all the way down to 6%, guess what? Trump still wins the Electoral College, as we show. And, you know, yes, Joe Biden won the national vote by, well, I guess, you know, he was declared winner of the national vote by millions and millions and millions of votes. He won the Electoral College. And when you look back, it's like, wow, he must have won in a landslide. No, he didn't, actually, because you know why? In the six key swing states, which it's all that matters in, you know, modern presidential elections, Joe Biden won by the most razor thin of margins, less than 10,000 votes in some of those. So those are the six states that really matter. And then if you look at the amount of mail-in voting that occurred in those states, and this Arizona really just blew our mind, more than 90% of all voting in Arizona was by mail. Are you serious? So then if you say, okay, fine, we'll get them to the benefit of the doubt. We'll say it wasn't 28%. We'll say it was maybe even as low as 6%. Well, guess what? Donald Trump still wins the election in every single one of those scenarios.
So let me drive that home again. They found that 28% of the voters they polled with Rasmussen, the Heartland Institute, 28% of voters committed fraud. Okay, 28% of the votes counted were fraudulent. And they have to get down to 6% total fraud in order for Biden to have a chance in the count. So this is why the idea that Joe Biden won this election is extremely unlikely. And Chris Tago with the Heartland Institute discussed that on my podcast.
You know, Barack Obama was one of the most popular presidents of all time. And somehow Joe Biden got more votes than Barack Obama. I mean, come on. That just strains credulity. It just does not make sense. And like you said, I remember vividly the 2020, campaign season. I remember Joe Biden hiding in his basement for most of the 2020 campaign season. And I remember when he did make campaign appearances, the gaffes were outrageous. So it does not make sense that, wow, right before the election, all these people just came out and said, you know what, I'm all in on Joe Biden. And all these people came out of the woodwork to vote for Joe Biden, even though he didn't really campaign. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It was an amazing thing as I recorded this video with Chris Tago with the Heartland Institute. It was an amazing thing to behold the electoral map and what the electoral map looked like at 28% fraud and 22% fraud and 16 and 12 and 6. And to realize just how massive a hole there is in our electoral system. Now, it's a fool's paradise in talk radio to criticize and not offer solutions. Chris Tago does offer solutions on fighting this vote fraud. They're not solutions you haven't heard before, but they've actually been tried and they worked.
So we recommend what Florida and Georgia did after 2020. So basically what Florida and Georgia did was they said, we want the citizens of our state to vote in person on election day. We want them to present photo ID on election day when they're voting in person. We want to make sure that if they are voting absentee by mail, that they have a valid excuse, whether they're disabled, they're serving overseas, military, or whatever. But they got to have an excuse. They also said, we want to make sure that we outlaw ballot harvesting, because that just is rife with fraud and corruption and all sorts of terrible stuff. Unattended drop boxes should not be left in public for people to just go and stuff 50, 100, 200 ballots in at any time, unsecure, no video cameras or anything. So really what they did was they just, they went back to the way things were. And what's so funny about that is Georgia in particular got a lot of flack. Brian Kemp got a lot of flack for this. I remember the All-Star game was pulled out of Atlanta because of all this terrible voting law. It's racist. It's voter suppression. Mm-hmm. But guess what happened in 2022? During the midterms in 2022, the amount of the percentage of minority voting went up.
And it did go up. You can go check the numbers. So we live in a world where we're told to believe the unbelievable. And this happens on a very, very consistent basis. But if you simply go back and listen and think about the superlative they used. Now, this is before the election had even been inspected. They said it was the safest, most secure election in history. With the loosest rules in history. With the first mass use of unattended Dropbox in history. With the first mail-in votes, where 90% of the votes came through mail, with no signature verification or very little, no checking of ID, where families received multiple ballots per individual. It was a lie. To say it was the safest, most secure election in history was a demonstrable lie because it hadn't been inspected. And you'll hear people say, well, all the courts have just thrown this out. Most of the courts refused to look at the evidence. The Supreme Court was the most ridiculous on this. When Texas sued and said Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, these other states violated the Constitution because they allowed their secretaries of state to change the voting rules when the federal Constitution says in races for federal office, the state legislators will make the rules, not single individuals. Texas sued and they said they violated the Constitution. Do you remember what the Supreme Court said? You don't have standing to sue. Certainly the Supreme Court couldn't ever hear a court case of one state versus many. That was also a lie. We'll come back on A Disciple's View with the Tower Babbling. I'm Todd Herman. Welcome back to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. If you ever want to get a glimpse of the reason why time is a great equalizer, time is an equalizer for human beings. It's not for God. Go to a physical therapy clinic. It's a fascinating thing to be around a group of people, all of whom have been injured in some way. And I had this epiphany hit me the other day when I was there. I've shared with you that I had a shoulder surgery, and a lot of people have been asking about the recovery. It's been magnificent. God is so good. His miracles are so grand. And in the physical therapy clinic where I go, I've gotten to know people because this is my second shoulder surgery. And I've become very good friends with my sports med doctor. He and I work out together and hang out together. We went to Mexico together, very good friend. And I got to know a lot of the staff and the owner. So, friends. But sitting in the clinic the other day, doing what I'm doing, I looked around me and I realized this is a portrait of time as equalizer. And the nature of our bodies as equalizer. All of us can be hurt. But there was something else I wanted to mention to you about that, and I'll wrap the show up that way because it's not just this physical stuff I saw. Certainly, people are there dealing with physical maladies and overcoming them, but there was something else that really hit me, which is our broken nature is also an equalizer and also one of the greatest opportunities we'll have as human beings to do as God has asked us to do, and that is to show that we are his disciples by the way that we love one another. And that really hit me just sitting there, laying there in the clinic, waiting for Dr. Ben to come over and work on me. I'll share that with you in a second. On this program, we thank the Lord for placing the supposedly wise people, like we've talked about today and yesterday, Fannie Willis and such, wise people on top of tall towers of shaking sand, shaking sand like lack of election integrity that we just talked about in the last segment. We thank God for placing the supposedly wise on these tall towers of shaking sand with their feature called the Tower Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents...
And I hope that... Prime Minister Xi has some
some difficulties right now.
The Tower of Babbling.
You know that the American media decided to make a martyr out of a guy from Russia. And he's probably been murdered. No one is here to say that that's Vladimir Putin is a decent guy. Every time we've spoken about him, I say he's a kleptocrat and has stolen the wealth that he's had. He's been a so-called public servant, and yet he is a billionaire, apparently many, many times over. But when there is a murder in Russia, and it's not a guy who's an American journalist, because there was an American journalist killed, apparently killed by Ukraine, the regime there, Gonzalo Lira. His dad went on Tucker Carlson's program and said, they're going to kill my son. And apparently they did. That hasn't made a dent in the Mockingbird media's approach to this war, of course, because he was a bad guy, because he questions Zelensky. But when it appears, and what we're told is that Alexei Navalny was murdered in a Russian prison, we get people like Jonathan Capehart. And Jonathan Capehart knows exactly who's to blame for this.
President Biden said today there's no doubt that Vladimir Putin's government is behind the death of the outspoken dissident Alexei Navalny. I want to start with your reaction and your assessment of the implications.
Well, it was shocking. Just because of who Navalny was in terms of the opposition, well-known opponent of Vladimir Putin, but also because of its timing, to my mind. The Munich Security Conference is happening right now. It is the most important gathering of national security and foreign policy leaders from around the world. And the announcement of Navalny's death came a few hours before Vice President Harris was supposed to speak, which was known. Mrs. Navalny was there to do a panel with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. This comes after, you know, we've been listening to Donald Trump saying if NATO doesn't pay its bills, well, then Russia can, quote, do whatever the hell they want. And so this sends, an incredibly chilling message to the world that Vladimir Putin, for lots of reasons, probably feels very, very emboldened. And when there's a major candidate running for president of the United States saying the things that he's saying, Putin probably feels confident that maybe come November, he'll have a friend in the White House and he can do whatever the hell he wants.
Jonathan Capehart is simply an installed mechanism of the Mockingbird media. You will notice that Vladimir Putin didn't invade Ukraine while President Trump was in office. That's the first of three clips in today's Tower Babbling, thanking the Lord for giving us an opportunity to behold the great wisdom of the elite class. There was a time that the Mockingbird media, this comes from Newsbusters, they used to love the 25th Amendment. This is the way in which you can remove a president who is not mentally fit. That day has, though, come and gone.
What exactly would have to happen to invoke the 25th Amendment in this country?
Obviously, in an ideal world, you would try to invoke the 25th Amendment, which I think is amply justified.
The man is deeply mentally unstable. The cabinet should convene immediately to discuss the 25th Amendment.
If he's crazy and incompetent and stupid, then we have to look at the 25th Amendment.
People in the president's inner circle have brought up the 25th Amendment at least 20 times.
This is 25th Amendment kind of stuff.
The whisper campaign over the 25th Amendment.
We're going to talk about the 25th Amendment.
Let's talk about the 25th Amendment.
Look at the 25th Amendment.
There is the 25th Amendment.
Consider the 25th Amendment.
Maybe we should consider the 25th Amendment.
The 25th Amendment.
How likely is it that the 25th Amendment
25th Amendment
25th Amendment
25th Amendment
25th Amendment
could be invoked?
The 25th Amendment 25th Amendment.
It kept going and going. I stopped it prematurely. So that was a time when the Mockingbird media was very, very interested in the 25th Amendment because President Trump was clearly mentally incapable of leading the country. In fact, probably insane, in addition to being literally Adolf Hitler anymore, though. There's no discussion of that. Since the 25th Amendment has disappeared, just like the phrase woman is now gone. Last up in today's Tower Babbling, Rob Reiner, speaking of women and what he refers to as choice. He knows something about those of us who are pro-life.
What made you decide to go all in on a project focused on Christian nationalism?
because it doesn't really reflect Christianity from what I understand. I mean, I went through a very tough time in my life many years ago, and I read about Christianity. I was raised as a secular Jew. There was no religion in my household. But I started reading about Christianity, about Buddhism, about Islamic religion, and I came away with understanding the real teachings of Jesus were about loving thy neighbor, doing unto others as you would have them done to you. And those are the things I latched onto, and they meant something to me. And when I saw this movement, it started, you know, in the 50s, but it really took hold in the 80s after Roe v. Wade became the law of the land. And Norman Lear had People for the American Way. And I started to see that there was a movement afoot that had nothing to do with what I understood to be the teachings of Jesus. And it was a pure political movement for power.
It's fascinating that Rob Reiner says he read about Christianity. Of course he read about it, same way he read about Buddhism. But of course he never asked the Lord Jesus to enter his heart, never asked to become a son of the king, because of course Rob Reiner is relying on his own wisdom. That's how you get the soft soap, C.S. Lewis called it the soft soap view of Jesus that Rob Reiner had, and he said it himself. That's the part that appealed to him. And so that's the part he chooses to say, explains that we Christians who don't want abortion, we just don't love our neighbor. And that's a wrap for today's Tower Babbling.
That was the Tower of Babbling.
Whoa! That is news.
On a Disciple's View.
So when I was at this, and I started to talk about this earlier, when this past week when I was in the physical therapy clinic getting my shoulder worked on, I was laying there waiting for who guys become my friend Ben to come by and work on my shoulder, and I know the people in the clinic, so I say hi to folks, and I know a lot of the therapists and therapist assistants, but at this point everyone was busy, and I had an opportunity to listen, because often I watch. And I'm a guy who really enjoys, observing people. I don't think in a creepy way, but I'm curious about people. And I think that in the physical therapy clinic, I've come upon this observation that time is this great equalizer. The nature of our bodies are equalizers. All of us age, some of us to a younger age than others before the Lord takes us. Some of us, sadly, go before the Lord, before we welcome the Lord into our hearts. But in this clinic, there's a 15-year-old girl who messed up her knee playing basketball. And I see her over there doing her thing and relating to these people as adults because they're, you know, older than her. But there's the fragility of her body, even at 15. And there's her desire to get back in the game. And I could see on her face at this time that I was just observing the place, this great concern. And I heard her ask her therapist, am I going to make it in for the season? And this conversation about that. And about three people down from her, there's a man who desperately wants to get his job back. I mean, he's on disability, but that's not what he wants. And his is a back issue, and it looks like a very bad one. I mean, he's effectively learning to walk again. And he wants his job back. And so time is this equalizer. She knows at 15 that the season ends at some point and she will have not played the rest of the season. He knows at some time, right, his life ends. It all wraps up. And he wants to get back into his game, and that game is supplying for his family. Even though, as I heard him discuss, it's not that they need the money. It's that he needs to work to be who he is. At this time, because I couldn't see people and I was laying down, I listened to the conversations. And something occurred to me, and I asked later my friends, how much of the work you do is mental? How much of the time you spend with people are you talking about their needs? And it's a very, very good clinic. It's also a Christian clinic. He goes, I pray with people all the time. Because you'd be surprised how many people come in here very, very ready to be prayed for. I'll ask before I do it. And if faith comes up in the conversation, I definitely engage, then is a very good Christian man and a disciple maker. But, he said, behind every physical hurt, there's something lurking. He said, in your case, when I came in with my first shoulder injury, I was terrified, utterly terrified, that I would never get to do the thing I love again, which is CrossFit. And it was Ben who looked me in the eye and said, yeah, it's bad. It's really bad. It's going to be a fantastic physical challenge for you and a great mental challenge. I said, can I come back? And he laughed and said, yes, it's going to be a great challenge. With other people, it's a different treatment. I heard a conversation between an older woman and one of the younger physical therapy assistants. And she was simply getting her ready for treatment. And if you've not been into a physical therapy clinic, they put a warm towel on the spot that they're going to manipulate or work on. And so I'm assuming by the way she was talking, she was laying on her stomach. And the towel's on there. And one of the therapists came over and started to visit with her. How's your week been? And she was thrilled with her week. Her daughter was in town. She got to see her grandkids. There's a new baby. And she was talking about the thrill of this and how God's so good to her that she got to see these kids. And then she said, but, what was the but? I couldn't hold my granddaughter. I'm not strong enough yet to hold her. So the little infant I could hold, but my sweet three-year-old who came running up to get into grandma's arms, I couldn't lift her up. And her mom stopped her, said, no, grandma's hurt. So if you could help me with one thing, it would be to get back to a point where I can hold my granddaughter. And the physical therapy assistant said the wisest thing. She said, okay, how much does she weigh? Oh, I don't know. Maybe 40 pounds? Okay. I guarantee you, I will work with you to the point that you can hold 40 pounds. So let's make that our goal for the end of this month. And you'll be able to hold your granddaughter again. Everybody's physical pain has somewhere behind it a mental pain. For me, it was, will I ever do what I love again? Sometimes the physical pain doesn't stop. And the question behind it is, where are you going then? You get to decide. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Until the Lord decides you and I can speak again together, on behalf of AFR and Randy, I'm Todd Herman. This has been A Disciple's View.